5 days ago, we celebrated the Buddha's first sermon. Setting the Wheel of Dharma in motion. We taught the Four Noble Truths in the context of the Eightfold Path. We taught about the duties with regard to those truths. And now, in having completed those duties, that constituted his awakening. The result of that talk was the leader of the five brethren, Gondanya, who became Anya Gondanya, gained the Dharma eye. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. In other words, he saw also what was not subject to origination, and that was not going to cease. So he became the first member of the Noble Sangha, and also the first member of the conventional Sangha. Well, the story doesn't end there. In the succeeding days, they say that the Buddha taught the Dharma to the remainder of the five brethren, so they all gained the Dharma eye. We don't know how many days it took, but there's a tradition in Thailand that on the fifth day, he gave a second recorded sermon, which we chanted just now. It has the name in general, so not self-characteristic, but that's the name that was given later. In the Pali Canon, it's simply called Five, which stands for the five brethren. They all became arahants. So the Buddha taught them about, he taught them earlier that suffering was the five clinging aggregates. And in the second sermon, he went through all five of the aggregates and pointed out that they were not self. The first part of the sermon, he was talking about how with each one of them, they don't lie totally under your control. You can't have them always be the way you want them to be. Now you can control them to some extent. This is why we can turn them into the path. But even with concentration, where we get the aggregates as solid and as constant as you can, you still see there are some ups and downs. It's not quite perfect. You have to maintain those states of concentration. So the mind is still not totally free. So that's the first attribute of self that the Buddha was talking about, that it was under your control, and these things were not totally under control. Then he went down a questionnaire. In each case, is this constant or inconstant? Well, it's inconstant. And if it's inconstant, is it stressful or easeful? It's stressful. And if it's inconstant and stressful, is it proper to say, this is me, this is myself, this is what I am? The answer is no. Notice he's not getting them to come to the conclusion there is no self. He's asking them to make a value judgment. Is this worth holding on to? As you've been practicing the path, you have been holding on to these things. And of course, prior to practicing the path, you're holding on to them more unskillfully, because you thought what you could get out of them was worth whatever effort went into them. Here the Buddha's finally saying, ultimately, no. And then he had them reflect further to draw some conclusions. This is what your experience is right now. This is what it's been in the past, made out of these same aggregates. In the future, as long as you stay samsaring, moving from state of becoming to state of becoming, it's going to be made out of the same aggregates. Past, present, future, near and far, refined, gross. Anywhere you could go, anywhere you might want to be reborn, it was all going to be the same aggregates. And it was that realization that made the five brethren all lose any interest in clinging to the aggregates anymore. So they let go. They all became arahants. The texts don't say that there was an earthquake. but it's one of those events that deserves to have an earthquake. The Buddha was able to teach people to gain total release. So how does that reflect on us? What does it teach us? Well, for one, think about the fact that the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths first, and then the perceptions of inconstant, stressful, not self later, in the context of the Four Noble Truths. Notice he doesn't call them characteristics. He never calls them characteristics in the canon. As I said, the title of the sutta that we know now is something that was added later. He calls them perceptions. And they're perceptions that are meant to give rise to a sense of dispassion, which after all is the duty with regard to that First Noble Truth, comprehended to the point of dispassion. And so even though he says that it's true that the aggregates have their pleasures, without their pleasures we wouldn't have latched onto them, but ultimately you have to come to the value judgment they're not worth it. Now you do that within the context of the Four Noble Truths, because as the Buddha teaches, when you're able to let go of the craving that leads to clinging, when you have dispassion for it, that's the cessation of suffering. So these are perceptions that you apply for a purpose. If you had no idea that dispassion would lead to the end of suffering, you'd want to hold on. This is probably why all of us are still holding on to our aggregates one way or another. You don't really believe the Buddha when he says if you develop dispassion for these things, it's going to be true happiness. We still have our passions. But it's useful to think about these perceptions as a way of chipping away at those passions. Because the Buddha wants you to see that the passion and suffering go together. We have this strange wall inside. We know there's suffering, but we don't see that it's connected to clinging. And often we don't see it's connected to craving. This is the problem with the mind. It puts up walls in places where they really benefit from tearing those walls down. But at the same time, it's important to reflect that those three perceptions are applied within the context of the Four Noble Truths. On their own, those perceptions couldn't tell you what to do. Okay, things are inconstant. What do you do? Some people say, well, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. And if you don't know the Four Noble Truths, that sounds reasonable. If something's not self, you say, well, to hell with it. I'm not going to care about it. There was one monk who, in the later years, heard the Buddha teaching about how the five aggregates were not self. And he came to the conclusion, well, if the aggregates are not self, then any action done by those aggregates is also not self. And who's there going to be to reap the rewards or to be affected by the actions of what is not self? It's an argument basically to say, hey, it doesn't matter what you do. There's nobody there either to do the action or to receive the results of the action, so any action you want to do is fine. And if you simply said, well, reality is not self, or there is no self, that would be a perfectly reasonable conclusion. So we have to remember, when you apply these perceptions in the context of the duties of the Four Noble Truths, and that's when they show their true use. But that's how they're circumscribed. And Jaya Mahaprabhu once commented, he felt that this, what was recorded of the second sermon, was incomplete, because it talks out only about how things that are fabricated are inconstant, stressful, not self. Where there's more that has to be let go of, there's a sense of the knower which seems to be permanent. That has to be let go of too. But apparently the five brethren were able to make that inference, that there was nothing worth holding on to. Because the idea of a permanent knower, that's just a perception. So they reflected that not only applied those perceptions of inconstant, stressful, not self to obvious levels of the aggregates, but also to more subtle ones. Because around that sense of the permanent knower, there is a sense, there is a feeling of well-being. There is a perception. There's some fabrication going on, and there's consciousness. So there are subtle levels of aggregates that are there as well. In some cases, the Buddha says, you know, sabbe tamanata. In order to get you to let go of even that permanent sense of the knower. But apparently the five brethren were able to let go because they were able to reflect on what they were doing. And for all these three perceptions are aggregates, so they have to be dropped as well. The lesson there is you really have to reflect. When you say the things outside are inconstant, stressful, not self, you have to turn around and say, well, what's going on inside as well? When the mind is talking to itself about how bad fabrications are, then you ask, so wait a minute. The mind talking to itself is also a fabrication, so you have to turn and look at that as well. This is one of the reasons why one of the prominent images of the Dharma is that the Dharma is like a mirror. You look out, but you also have to look back in. You act, but you also have to reflect. To learn to have this all-around gaze, the five brethren were able to take what the Buddha taught and work out the implications. So that they were able to drop everything, including the path. Once the path had done its work, don't try dropping the path too early. But there will come a point where you realize there's nothing else for the path to do. That's when you have to drop it. So always reflect. Even when you're just doing concentration practice, this is what directed thought and evaluation are all about. You direct your thoughts to the breath, and then you evaluate how good the breath is, and then you evaluate how well the mind is staying with the breath. You have to. And John Lee makes the comparison. He says, alertness is like a pulley. You pull the rope in one direction, and you pull the rope in the other direction. You look at the object of your mindfulness, and you turn around and look at the mind, watching the object of the mindfulness. Keep this double perspective. Another image the Buddha gives is of the person sitting looking at someone who's lying down, or someone who's standing looking at the person sitting. You have to learn how to watch yourself. Learn how to reflect. Because ignorance likes to hide in your blind spots. And if you don't look all around, it's hard to say a blind spot. It's like a blind hemisphere. So take them as good examples, the five brethren. We celebrate the fact that the Buddha was able to teach them, but we also celebrate the fact that they were able to follow him, work out the implications, and free their minds. The Buddha didn't free their minds. They freed their own minds. He helped them. He gave them all the tools. And they learned how to use those tools. So think of all the Dharma you've learned as tools. And watch yourself as you use those tools. And that's how you become a master.